Welcome along. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That means it's 9 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. Oh, wait, we've just had... Let me have a look at this. It's from Jeffrey Gilbert. Jeffrey Gilbert says he can't stand the time zone recitations at the beginning of every Clubland Q&A, so he no longer listens to it live. He only listens to it on tape. Okay. Well, I won't bother doing the time zone recitations on today's show then. He says it's like boring. He's heard it 43 times. I'm feeling kind of wan and listless without doing the time. That's like kind of what that's what excites me about doing the show. I think that's where you may have missed the point, Jeffrey. It's like the time zone recitations is not because you happen to know now what time it is in Berlin or Cairo or Moscow, but because it like peps me up and feels like I've got lots of pep and spirit to do the show, and now I'm just like drifting aimlessly. Oh dear. So anyway, it's a low-key start. Let's get to your questions then and see if I can poke myself up in the course of the show. Beth says, I'm really enjoying 1984. 1984 is our current serialization as part of Tales for Our Time. We'll be doing the latest episode in a couple of hours from now, this evening. That's North American Eastern Time, which will be about 2 a.m. Greenwich. Oh, no, I'm doing time zone recitations again. Anyway, that's when we'll be doing the latest episode of 1984. Beth says, like many, I read it in high school, but it has even greater resonance today, especially as read by Mark Stein. What do you think about our own new speak, defining the proposal to treat people differently based on their race or ethnicity as equity? When I was a child, we were taught to treat everyone equally, as you yourself would want to be treated, and that it was wrong to discriminate based on a person's race or ethnicity. Yes, it's very interesting, this. Equality, to which you allude, Beth, is out, and equity is in. Poor old Joe Biden stumbled, as he was saying. He's basically manned, or whoever's operating him, whoever's got his hand up that dead husk and is waggling him about, said that he got confused and he actually said the word equality because he goes back so far, he remembers when equality was the thing. And whoever uses the earpiece to contact with him and tell him what to say, no, equity. And he corrected himself and said equity. These are two very different things. And you're right, actually, to draw attention to them. It's not a small thing when you mandate equity, social justice. You know, in other words, we don't have justice now. We have social justice, which is the antithesis of justice. But as far as Newspeak is concerned, Beth, that's actually quite subtle. Because most people think that equality and equity are the same thing, in the same way that when you talk about systemic racism or... people think systemic and systematic are the same thing. That it's actually quite a subtle thing when you evolve a word. You just shorten, take a syllable out or add a syllable, but it sounds approximately in the same territory as the previous word. I wonder if we're not actually in a cruder time now, because I just happened to see... just before the show started, that Black Lives Matter has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. If you don't know who Black Lives Matter are, they're the guys, if you're like in Minneapolis or whatever, they're the guys rampaging through the street and tearing down the statue and tossing it in the river, looting Macy's, you know, whatever. But they've actually been nominated. The looters and the rioters have been nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize. I'll be interested to see whether those Norwegians actually buy that. And that's actually very Orwellian because it's where the Nobel Peace Prize is rewarding a violent organization for looting and burning and pillaging, actually, in some cases. And so we are actually in the full Orwellian. War is peace, freedom is slavery, ignorance is strength, and looting and rioting gets you a peace prize. I always have trouble. Every time, I think George Pazin pronounces it Pazin, and I always used to give it a bit of a Quebecois flavour by pronouncing it Georges Pazin. And I can't remember now whether that enraged George or whether Georges quite enjoyed it. George Pazin, Georges Pazin says, "Here's my question. Is the GameStop story the single best encouraging story of the last decade plus? The regular people, ignored and condescended to by the ruling elites, rising up to attack the ruling elites. This is David versus Goliath writ large, and I'm rooting for David." I'm assuming most people around the planet have heard about this. These are like these, you know, it's a short selling on Wall Street, something, an activity that really is of no benefit, creates nothing. It's an activity of no social use whatsoever, but it is can be very enriching. And it's generally speaking, people can become billionaires by doing it. And it's generally speaking, an activity engaged in and restricted by the few. And what happened, as you know, in recent days is that fellas connected via Reddit and various other things on the internet managed to insert. And actually, it's the ultimate in insider trading, or at least self-fulfilling prophecy, because before the short sellers get going, they'll often actually go on all these business channels that are out there now and announce that this or that company is dead, it's going to zero. In other words, they often create the conditions that enable them to enrich themselves. And what happened is that a bunch of regular folks managed to get in on the action, and they've actually succeeded in putting, like, this one big short-selling A-lister, he's kaput now, and he said he's adopting an entirely different business model. But what is interesting to me about this is that the elites rig everything now. We live in a world where these are closed elites. There's not a lot of, you know, the function of the big name universities in America, like Harvard, is essentially admission to the elites. And then when you are in these groups, their idea is that all the other people are on the outs and are closed off from it. And that includes even things like elements of the stock market, elements of Wall Street. And what I think is, what I find very heartening about this story, which has absolutely got Wall Street in a panic, because it's like discovering a flaw you never realized, that you didn't know were there, is that if people can just get in on the action completely outside the system and do what they've been doing in the last few days, that's terrible to them, and they're in a panic. And you're seeing things now where companies are restricting, for example, I don't think actually today you can buy more than a single share of GameStop. I think they said a few hours ago, today you can only buy one share, because these guys figured out a weakness in the system and got into it. And if you're wondering what GameStop is, I think they actually sold physical video games, if you can remember those. And I have a vague memory once of going to a shopping mall, and I was looking for a Staples or something like that, and there was a GameStop shop next to it. I couldn't reliably tell you what state that shopping mall was in, but I have a vague memory of like passing a GameStop in 2003 or something. It's like a name from the past. All the action this week has involved names from the past, because the, you know, the short sellers are about companies that are going down. So all the action has been about GameStop, Nokia, and BlackBerry. I can't remember the last time. I think I watched an Australian TV show the other day, and it was like from 10 years ago or something, 15 years ago probably, and a guy had a BlackBerry in it. And I was thinking, oh, yeah, look, that guy's got a BlackBerry. So what's fantastic about this story, and this is the larger picture of it, Georges or George, is that, you know, right now people are on the outs. We've got a resurgence in Washington. The swamp is back. The globalists are back. John Kerry is the climate advisor to the United States government, shutting down the Keystone Pipeline, putting 11,000 people out of work and saying, well, they should do some kind of other job. And if you just leave it to the globalists, they'll all get together in Davos and they'll decide what jobs you're permitted to do. And on the political side in America, increasingly... And I think it's true in other countries too. I've called it the post-democratic era. Increasingly, politics is insulated from popular pressure. So they can basically decide that there are subjects you can't talk about, that there are subjects that are beyond the differences, the nominal differences in the United States between the two political parties and the slightly wider variety of political parties elsewhere. And they're just off the... So it doesn't really matter who you elect. Nothing's ever going to be done about immigration. There's not going to be really any changes on China. Some things are just beyond. And the great thing about this is that in the end, the GameStop thing, is that in the end, people will find a way to get in and wreck the elite systems. And that's what's inspirational about this. Because in a way, that's the ultimate elite activity, Wall Street. I know they say this thing now, oh, everyone's, so many people, over half the country are invested in the stock market. It's all rubbish, that. That means a guy's got a 401k, which for our non-Americans is, a retirement plan. People say it's a pension plan. So people say, oh, yeah, he's investing. No, it means he's got a guy's got a 401k. He's not, that doesn't mean he's a player on Wall Street. The players on Wall Street don't want there being players out there in Idaho and Montana and parts of rural Maine, because then the whole system slips out of their control, and that's what's inspirational about it. Lovely. Mike Carroll says we should have Hatchaturian in that. We should have the Sabre dance whenever Sabre Mike Carroll weighs in. He says, Mark, in pro wrestling, there's a term for doing something that makes it completely obvious that the whole thing is not on the level, exposing the business. The GameStop thing was the single biggest expose of the truth about our government and financial institutions possible. You had a group of sleazy Wall Street types have the tables turned on them, only to essentially force the entire system to be shut down because they were losing. Our ridiculous media and politicians tried to justify this by claiming the Reddit folks were white supremacists and thus were the bad guys and not the billionaire vultures receiving their long overdue comeuppance. When Biden's flack got asked about it, she went into a nonsensical identity politics diatribe. I think this is Jen Psaki you're referring to, who I think she was asked a question about this and didn't really have an answer, and so pointed out that Biden's Treasury Secretary, Janet Yellen, is the first female Treasury Secretary. So... that doesn't really address the issue. And who cares about these? It's all so bloody boring, isn't it? Who cares about the first female trade? Does anyone real ever actually care about these things? I mean, you know, I can't... We're going back now 6 decades since Israel had Golda Meir and Ceylon had Mrs. Bandaranaike as prime minister and Mrs. Gandhi. Does anyone really get in? So bloody bored. If all you can say is, oh, we've got the first film. Oh, look, here's the first film, shattering the glass ceiling, whereas the glass ceiling that matters is actually being shattered in the GameStop thing. Anyway, Sabre Mike says, Biden's flack went into a nonsensical identity politics diatribe. They're siding with horribly corrupt Wall Street types while attempting to Jedi mind trick everyone into ignoring this by screaming Nazis and thinking everyone is too stupid to notice. If this doesn't red pill everyone, then I seriously don't know what else will. Do you think this will be a turning point, or will the boat continue on its way to the end of Niagara Falls? Well, as I said, I think it's interesting that when you have, we now, essentially, these guys in the globalist elites have pulled up the drawbridge behind them. That's always the, that's what a lot of this is all about. John Kerry, who's back, and I can't really believe this, you know, talk about the swamp at its swampiest. But John Kerry, he was giving some speech to a university a couple of years ago, and he said, "You are the first generation to live in a borderless world." And I referred to this in a speech I was giving, I think somewhere in Arizona, actually, to a bunch of hedge funders who aren't the best audience, I must say. They just, I can't stand speaking to hedge. No disrespect to any hedge funders listening, but I can't stand addressing a room full of hedge funders, and I've given up on it. And almost as soon as I gave up on it, the whole public speaking industry collapsed because it's illegal now. Anyway, John Kerry was saying that you're the first generation to live in a borderless world. And what I discussed when I made a few remarks about it was that, you know, for these people at elite universities, it is a borderless world. You know, you graduate, you might go and work on Wall Street for a couple of years, and then somebody says, "Hey, come and be in Hong Kong and Singapore for a bit." And so you go and work over there, and then you go and work for some Swiss or German bank, and it is a borderless world. It's not a borderless world if you own a home that you bought for $130,000 in a town that's dead because the mill is closed, the factory is closed, there's nothing to do but work at the quickie crap or deal heroin. And so your house was $130,000 and now it's $70,000. And there's like a lot of people like that all over America and all over the world. And we now have less social mobility than ever before. I mean, really a huge decline in social mobility, particularly in the United States. These, as I said, these people are pulling up the drawbridge behind them. So it's fantastic that people are finding ways to get in there, just like finding weaknesses in the system to get in there and disrupt the elites. It's terrific. It's terrific. What I find interesting about it, though, Saber Mike, is that they're doing it outside of politics. In other words, the political system is frozen. It's very hard to get in and get at the elites in the political system, as we know. But finding non-political ways is good and is inspirational. John Barrett writes, "Hi, Mark, regarding a third party, the left took over the Democratic Party. Why can't the right take over the Republican Party, support Hawley and Stefanik, etc.? Isn't that a much more feasible idea than starting a third party? Thanks, John." Well, I talked about this on Rush because of this interesting thing that showed that if Trump, a poll showing that if Trump started a third party, then they would in effect be the second party. The polls showed that the Democrats would come first. Whatever Trump's new party is called, the Patriot Party, whatever, would come second, and the Republicans would come third. And then there was another poll I saw that showed that actually a majority of Republicans want a third party. Republican, there's a difference. You compare the situation. The Democrats, generally speaking, even at the Bernie level, the Democrat base doesn't loathe the party as much as the Republican base loathes the Republican Party. So I think that is actually a difference. Secondly, I'm actually philosophically in favour of more parties, as you know. I explained why on Rush. I don't think it's healthy. It's the only country in the world. It's part of the things that make America not quite a respectable society, that you have two frozen parties for 150 years, which you don't have in any other part of the Western world. Parties outlive their natural lives and are succeeded by new parties. Macron's party was basically invented in order that he would en marche, forward, or whatever it's called, onward, was basically invented in order that he'd have a party to represent when they Marine Le Pen, his principal opponent, that was a fringe party that became a mainstream party, and then, unlike her, she wanted to put a little bit of distance between her and her dad, so she renamed the party. So I'm philosophically in favour of, I'm both philosophically in favour of more parties in America, and I'm also, as a practical matter, interested in killing the Republican Party. I'm interested in killing the Democrat Party too. But to kill the I'm more and more forced to the conclusion that in order to kill the Democrat Party, one might first have to kill the Republican Party. That's the point of that. But as to whether you could actually pull a Bernie or pull an AOC and drag the Democrat Party, who dragged the Democrat Party to the far left, hence all this talk about equity and the need for massive taxes in order to eliminate bovine flatulence, whether it would not be possible to do that for the right and to the Republican Party, drag the Republican Party to the right. I think it's a whole other challenge there. That for a start, there's cultural support. The reason the Democrat Party goes to the left is because the culture, all the people who matter in the Democrat Party, are prominent players in the culture who are interested in things like transgender bathrooms. All the things that would pull a Republican Party to the right, for example, getting serious about China or ending mass immigration, which I'm in favour of, as you know, have no support in the culture. So the conditions there would be very different. Also, I do think there's something particular about this moment. If the election was stolen, as I believe it was, the president had crap lawyers who bungled those cases. I mean, I'm not even. You can complain about American judges. I've been up against American judges, and believe me, I know they're low quality. So let's take all that as read. But even so, those were lousy briefs, lousy motions that were filed. I'll expand on that if anyone's interested. I can do chapter and verse on it. But if you believe, as I do, that the election was a fraud, and America is actually the only G7 member that, for example, in the Freedom House ratings on the electoral system and the management of elections, does not get a proper score. It only scores like 3 out of 4, 75%. So it has there are issues here. So if you believe the election was stolen, and it was stolen because of mass use of mail-in ballots, which no serious country should do, then it's just going to be stolen next time and the time after that. So you might as well at least, you know. So in that case, why just keep investing in the same losing vessel? You know, if there is a time to actually go for it, then this would be a good time to go for it. Oh, Pamela says, can you say the Durham Report a few times to the energy and excitement? The Durham Report! Oh, the Durham Report is coming. Yes, the Durham Report is coming. I compared it unfavorably with the Earl of Durham's report in Canada over the rebellions of 1837 and 1838. That Durham Report, I think the following year, 1838, Lord Durham sailed back from Quebec City, got to London, laid it before Parliament. As you know, well, as you probably don't know, actually, because I don't hear much about the Earl of Durham on American talk radio. But the Earl of Durham, that had huge consequences for responsible government in Nova Scotia in 1848, which in turn led to the British North America Act, the Canadian Constitution in 1867, and indeed all the other constitutions around the British Commonwealth, up to and including, I think either South Georgia or the South Sandwich Islands got a little bit of a constitution in the last couple of years. So that's how influential that Lord Durham was. And he didn't take all the years that this guy did. So I can't believe this. You know, I switched on Fox News, I think it was yesterday, and they were talking about the Durham Report as if it was a serious thing. If you're still talking about the Durham Report as if it's a serious... This guy... I think we've got another question about the Durham. But you just like it the way I say, the Durham Report is coming. Ooh, any day now. The Durham Report is coming, and then you'll see. Then Comey and McCabe and Brennan and Clapper, they're really going to get it. Yeah, Robert writes, as you know better than I do, the third party stuff can actually work for a while, as shown by the Reform Party. On this side of the border, says Robert, writing from the Dominion of Canada, the Reform Party ended up swallowing the remnants of the useless, quote, progressive conservatives. That was actually the name of the party. For American readers, sort of like the rhinos, without their deep commitment to actual conservative policies. And bringing most of them to heel, going on to actually win government. Could the Donald pull off a Grover Cleveland Reform Party Act? Again, it's about, you know, the moment. Right now, most of those 74 million people are mad that Biden, by whatever method, succeeded in taking out Trump. And what's interesting is that the Republican Party hasn't even bothered disguising how it just wants to go back to small ball politics. You know, I think even Ted Cruz is talking about tax cuts or something today. So that's the question here. You know, is this the moment? Will a better moment ever come again? And that's a real question. Greetings, Emily Greenberg says, greetings, Mark. If you could transport yourself in a time machine to any decent point in history, what time would you choose? These current times we're in are making me wish for one of those machines. Merci, says Emily. I don't know whether that's a clue, whether she is writing from La République Française or from Quebec or somewhere, but she wants to know what time I'd go back. I said 1848. I would probably go back to somewhere between 1848 and 1914. I look on that as a golden period. It was a golden period not just for global stability, which helps, but it was also a golden period for science. Whoever it was who said the great invention was the great invention of the 19th century. In other words, that was the period through which almost all the things that transformed our lives were invented. As you know, electricity, the light bulb, that's when man conquered darkness. Do you know what a pain in the neck it must have been? Just to, as the sun goes down, think, okay, that's it. I might as well go to sleep because there's nothing else to do. The motor vehicle conquered distance. These were great inventions whose impact utterly transformed the way we live our lives. And yet, at the same time, it was also a time of, as I said, global stability and expanding individual liberty, so that in A.J.P. Taylor's famous quote that an Englishman could live his entire life, up to August 1914, an Englishman could live his entire life without encountering the state in any form other than his greeting his postmistress and his village constable when he went down to mail a letter in the course of the day. Speaking of the Durham report, Eric Dale says, "Hey, Mark, I just read that Kevin Kleinsmith, the FBI lawyer who pleaded guilty to falsifying a document to justify the Russia investigation of the Trump administration, got probation and community service. He might as well have pleaded guilty to a misdemeanor in a county courthouse. I wonder what your thoughts are on the Durham investigation compared to the Adam Mackey indictment for posting memes in the 2016 election. Personally, I think things like this are why the conservative movement needs to jettison the Republican Party and set up a new party. The contemporary Republican Party starts out in historic tax cut that nets most people a few hundred dollars a year and ends up with Hank Paulson on a knee begging Nancy Pelosi for yet another in a never-ending series of corporate bailouts. It talks about small government but says nothing when COVID lockdowns restrict virtually every constitutional liberty. It's 4 years and counting on the Durham Report while the Biden administration indicts someone for posting memes on the 2016 election. Yeah, who knew they could move fast when they have to? If only this guy investigating Adam Mackey, because they basically decided to go get him in nothing. But this guy, Kleinsmith, the Department of Justice and the FBI, I'm in favour of abolishing both of them and replacing them with newer bodies with far more restricted powers. Because right now, the Department of Justice, dirty, rotten, stinking, corrupt federal justice, which again is something that Americans should be ashamed about. It's a rotten system. It's a corrupt system. The FBI is part of that dirty, rotten, stinking, corrupt system. And this guy, Kleinsmith, is basically what the mob do when they attract a little more attention that they want, and they have a designated fall guy whom they pay to go to jail. And that's nobody's heard of Kevin Kleinsmith. We've all been told, Peter Strzok and Lisa Page, they were all talking about their, the backup plan they had in case Trump won the election. And Andrew McCabe, and then Nelly Ohm, and then Christopher Steele, and then Clapper and Brennan, all the people you've heard. And then they say, oh, yeah, no, never mind any of those guys. This guy, Kevin Kleinsmith, the only guy who'll be going to jail, the only guy this useless guy Durham has actually targeted, he gets probation and community service. So it's worse than the mob. He doesn't even have to go to jail. The mob guys, they'll say, we'll give you $15,000 to go to jail. Say you did it and go to jail on the mob boss's behalf, and we'll give you 15 grand. This guy, he doesn't even have to go to jail. He gets probation and community, the designated for. It's a mob racket, the DOJ. Al Mann from CA, which I believe is California rather than Canada, says, hi, Mark. Well, here we are, a senile commander-in-chief, an administration full of socialists, Obama retreads, anti-Trump conspirators and idiots. All executive orders have been anti-American and designed to lose jobs and redistribute our imaginary wealth. Non-leftists are to be spied upon and possibly jailed. Has the swamp and China finally won? P.S. You were right on with your FBI comment on Tucker. I've researched for 4 years and have yet to find a single whistleblower from the rank and file. Not one. That is very true. It's not it's not that they finally won. But it is grim. It's absolutely grim. Because China is certainly the beneficiary of this victory. And the swamp, I mean, to see these swamp creatures all back, basically, if you want the short history of the last 4 years, it's I fought the swamp and the swamp won. And it doesn't matter necessarily that they did it by stealing the election or whatever, because they steal everything. They came in trying to steal the election. They just had a very complex plot involving Australian high commissioners in London, and it all got a bit too complicated. and didn't quite come off. So this time round, they came up with an easier plot. They just stole it. And that's that. But it is bad. This, in the next 4 years, China is the dominant power on the planet. So anybody who wants your vote in America, America isn't suited to be number two. You know, some people don't mind losing global dominance. You know, people from great empires can enjoy post-imperial decline. If you're sitting in Vienna enjoying a Sacher-Torte and a coffee, decline can seem very agreeable. And you don't really mind that you were a great empire and now you're just a nothing little country nobody really pays any attention to. I don't think Americans are suited for that. I don't think they're cut out not to be number one. I remember, this would be about a decade ago, I was guest hosting for Sean Hannity. And what had happened was that America had just been downgraded by Moody's from, at the time of, you know, this would be just after all the Lehman Brothers. And I had Eric Bolling on, who subsequently disappeared from Fox because of alleged photographs he'd been emailing around. But so I asked Eric Bolling about this, and he said, "Well, this is ridiculous. Who cares if we look at the list of countries who haven't been downgraded by Moody's? Norway. Why should we even be in the same hit parade as Norway? They should have all these other pipsqueak countries like Norway off in some other hit parade of their own, and they should have a category just for us." Ah, I scoff at Moody's downgrading of America. And I thought he was ridiculous. But in the spirit of the World Series and the Super Bowl, you know, the old John Cleese line when he was doing the differences between Britain and America, and the one joke was that when we meet our head of state, we only have to get down on one knee. That was in the Clinton era, that gag, as you can tell. And he said, and when we hold a world championship, we invite teams from other countries. That was his other one. But, you know, Eric Bolling, in a sense, is right. America is not temperamentally cut out to be one of the loser nations of history. It's not one of these, you think, oh, national greatness. Oh, Portugal was once great. The Netherlands, they invented capitalism. They were great. Spain, great mighty trading empire. Even Britain, Mother England. I was telling this to my American lawyer. He couldn't believe it. I said, like, around 1928, 1929, the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council, you talk about a high court, the Judicial Committee of the Privy Council had jurisdiction over a quarter of the planet. And he couldn't wrap his head around that because, you know, we're used to dealing with the DC Court of Appeals and the New York Appellate Court. I'd have an ultimate appeal court, would, you know, and everyone gets, okay, it comes, it goes. One minute you're on the, you're number one, then you're number two, then you're number seven, then you're number 34. Americans aren't cut out for that. And the difference as well, of course, is that as the Chinese always see it, for the first time in 500 years, it's not where one European power or one Anglophone power is being succeeded by another. It's not like the Battle of Trafalgar two centuries ago when France and England are battling for who will bestride the 19th century. It's not like the end of the Second World War where Mother England is ceding global dominance to its prodigal son. We're actually ceding dominance. The Chinese executed a Chinese businessman today. I think he was 58 years old. They executed him for embezzlement. Now, I know what you're saying. Wouldn't it be great if they did that to Hunter Biden or those Wall Street short sellers? Well, you know, as I said, we're ceding dominance to a totalitarian state that executes you for embezzlement. It's a big difference. Grandma Judy says, not to be depressing, but do you see us getting into a war with China by backing up Taiwan? Lots of saber-rattling going on over there. I've said the Chinese are planning something big for the 100th anniversary of the Chinese Communist Party in June, and what they'd like is they'd like to have Taiwan back in the fold. Now, we're committed to militarily defending them. I don't think that's a goer. I think too much is made in... if you look at the supply chain disruptions just from the COVID, where they actually sat on the good masks, the good PPE, they make, as I always say, they make all the pills, you know, so they make everything you can think of. They make your clothes, they make your laptops, they make your medicines. I don't actually know whether we... So people think, oh, yeah, we shouldn't be going to war because it'd just be like Afghanistan. We'd be bogged down for 20 years. You can't be bogged down for 20 years when the people who supply everything you need to keep you in good shape, from your aspirin to your suppositories. It's no good to have the best bombers in the world if you've got a splitting headache because there's no aspirin available at CVS. You know, I don't think we could. I don't honestly think we could win that war, to be honest, and I don't see. I think there's an understanding of that, and that there would be, whatever the treaty obligations to Taiwan, there would be a great attempt at finessing our way out of that. Rather, you know, there's treaty obligations over Hong Kong, for example. That's an international treaty, and China basically tore that up. And if you notice, my old pal Boris Johnson hasn't said a word in consequence about that. A word of consequence about that. Michael Meegan, I think he pronounces it. He and his wife have come on our first two Mark Steyn cruises. And Michael says, Mark, hugely enjoying, he's one of my fellow Irishmen. Michael says, Mark, hugely enjoying your output in these difficult times. Have been on the first two cruises. What hope of the Med cruise, the Mediterranean cruise? That's October happening. I think it is going to happen. People want liberation from lockdown, and this cannot go on. In where Michael lives, it's illegal. I just saw this on the. It's illegal for more than two people to gather outdoors. I don't know how you can even gather with two. Is two people a gathering? Yeah, I know. We've all had bad nights. We've all done shows in obscure towns where the ticket sales weren't quite what you hoped for, and you talked your way up. I don't think I'd have even ever tried to pass off two people as a gathering. You've well documented the decay of the West, says Michael. The big problem for all of us is who to vote for. Here in the UK, the Tories are as wet as the rest. Will you start a party here so I don't need to spoil my vote next time? A Brexit supporter. Yeah, the British Tories believe in nothing. They're led by a man who, all the years I've known Boris has never really believed in anything. He's had this sort of He has a conservative temperament because he seems like a bluffer, like a buffer, the sort of saloon bar buffer. He has a persona that seems conservative, but he doesn't actually believe in anything. Someone's got to believe in something. Again, it gets back to this Republican Party in the United States. It gets back to the conservatives in Canada. Gets back to it's true in much of the English-speaking world. And it's an interesting contrast with the continent, for example, where the latest poll shows Marine Le Pen and and Macron neck and neck as they go. I think next year is 2022 is the presidential election, and we don't need milquetoast believe nothing conservative parties like Andrew Scheer in Canada or a Nikki Haley led Republican Party in 2024, or we need parties that believe in something and can persuade people of it very fast, because we're not there yet. So I'm so bored by saying, oh, you should just put up with Paul Ryan, Mitch McConnell, cautious incrementalism, because we're way past that. That's true throughout the West. You know, our societies will very quickly go past the point of no return if people are not actually putting clear blue water between themselves and the dominant left of centre parties, whether that's the Democrats or the Canadian Liberals, UK Labour Party, Australian Labour Party, whatever. And what is where the moment was, and that this is why both what happened after Brexit and what happened after Trump's election are a disappointment in where we stand now, is that the realignment, if you look at someone like Marine Le Pen, the one thing she's got going for her is that she's culturally conservative. We hear talk about fiscally conservative, socially liberal. That's all the people. That's what Boris purports to be. People who say that, you know, so they're all hot for gay marriage and they're hot for they're indifferent to abortion and they're all out, but they're fiscally conservative. And generally speaking, because the social liberalism comes with quite a price tag, none of those people. Your Arnold Schwarzeneggers, your Christy Whitmans, these pathetic governors of Massachusetts and New York State, so-called Republicans, none of them are really fiscally conservative either. They're just big nothings. And the realignment that's happened in continental Europe is a slightly different, is actually the opposite in some ways. You know, someone like Marine Le Pen doesn't question the role of the state when it comes to welfare or whatever. But what she is culturally conservative. That's true of equivalent parties in Italy and Austria, the Netherlands, Belgium, Scandinavia. And it's the most interesting realignment in some ways since the welfare state began. And I think cultural conservatism is actually the place to be. So if I had a little more time on my hands, maybe I'll start an empire-wide cultural conservative party. We'll have candidates in Canada and the UK, Australia, New Zealand, Turks and Caicos. We'll get to all of them. But that's where the action is, Michael, and it's an interesting difference between the continent and the so-called Anglosphere right now. Travis Sutherland says, Mark, are we really resigned to now deal with the steel? If it is indeed true that we've just gone through such a blatant, undeniable coup to install the most compromised and corrupt foreign enemy asset tyrants in our nation's history, how and why are we just moving on? If voting and indeed the Constitution itself are no longer reliable or viable to reverse course, what is now our recourse? It seems like we should be stopping at nothing and incessantly demanding justice and restoration of the rule of law like our lives and futures depend on it. Well, what you got to do here, I don't think you should accept the steal. I don't believe I've actually referred to Joe Biden as President Biden yet. I think I called him President-alleged Biden on Rush the other day. I may have called him Mr. Biden occasionally. And as you know, if you saw Chris Wallace barking at whoever it was, Chris Wallace gets very indignant if you don't call Joe Biden by his proper name. So people are being forced to live with it. I'm interested in people like Rand Paul who actually want to pursue have energetic campaigns in these six so-called swing states, where a few thousand votes made the difference between Trump's second term and this dead husk sitting behind the Oval Office desk, and actually see about those guys reversing the unconstitutional travesties that permitted the election to be conducted in this way. Otherwise, the Republican Party is just the permanent minority party, and there's no point wasting time with it. Of course, and again, to go back to a point I often make, what happens is that when something like this comes up, there are no supporters for the Trump side or the Republican side in the wider world, because the right hold none of the cultural levers of power. So the way issues are framed, so count every vote. If you're the average person uninterested in politics, because to be interested in politics is a weird thing, because all the people you're interested in are so bloody boring. I mean, why would you want to be interested in someone like Mitch McConnell? So it's weird. Most people are not interested in politics. It's just even ones who vote, even ones who claim to be informed, they're not obsessive about it, and their knowledge of it is at a relatively shallow level. And that means that when you say things like count every vote, people say, oh, yeah, count every vote. Why, yeah, why are the Republicans trying to not count every vote? But if we don't actually get this reversed, then there is no, it's not going to be, it's even bigger waste of your time than it normally is being interested in Mitch McConnell, because he's not going to be anybody, and the people who succeed him aren't going to be anybody. Kevin Clark writes, hi Mark, you've made it pretty clear you think the election was stolen. Personally, I think it's worse than that, that Biden actually got more votes, that after winning the culture, the progressives actually have more voters choosing them. And even if it wasn't true in 2020, that with better election supervision, we could have dragged Trump across the finish line in a few more swing states, the progressives still control the schools, the media, churches, most corporations, etc. And it's only natural that's going to produce more votes. Do you see a way forward? Yeah, I don't think there's, just to be clear here, I think the election was stolen in those swing states. But there's no denying to the core reality. I don't think he won by 7 million votes or whatever the official number is, but I think it is the case that Biden won the popular vote, if only because the Republican candidate has only won the popular vote once in the last 30 years, and that was Bush in 2004. And eventually, if you keep losing the popular vote, that will start to make your map to 270 electoral votes narrower and narrower. So there is an issue with the basic lack of popularity of serious conservative ideas. I don't necessarily disagree from your analysis that if you've got a one side that controls the schools, the media, the churches, the corporations, the places where people live their lives, then the default setting of society is not very favorable to you. And the schools, I said this a decade ago, that was the biggest structural defect in America. It's not even like the old Oxford University debate in 1933 or whatever it was, that this house would not fight for king and country. So you're talking about privileged elite varsity types indulging the sort of thing you talk about at university. It's not even that you've got, that was shocking to people, but it was university students. What's pathetic now is that that kind of thinking goes back down through university, through high school, through middle school, through grade school, all the way to kindergarten. And unless you do something about it, I'm always interested in hearing ideas of how we arrest that, how we change it, how we get back in there, back in the schools, back in the culture, back in the media, back in the churches, back in the corporations. You know, we still have this thing, all businessmen, they're like the top hat guy on the front of the Monopoly box, and they're woker than anybody. This perversion of woke capitalists, the beneficiaries of capitalism, destroying capitalism. And we have things that have got no appeal. You say you think there's actually more voters choosing them. I watched Mark Levin the other day, and yes, you know, Mark Levin sued me twice. His vanity streaming network sued me twice. So you know I have and lost both times. To hell with him. But so you know there's a personal animus here, but it's not all personal animus, just about 97% of it. But the other 3% looked at Mark Levin on TV waving around the pocket constitution. I don't think that actually resonates with... I don't think that's going to... I'll be blunt about it. I don't think that's going to convert a single American right now to the conservative cause, because it's not about abstractions. There's so many great issues here. You know, I understand a conservative constitution isn't an abstraction. It's the basic law of your nation. But the law is interpreted by judges, and the judges are appointed either by Democrats or by whomsoever Mitch McConnell thinks he can sneak past Susan Collins. So you wind up with those judges who decline to hear the Trump election lawsuit that won filed by Texas, either because they think the courts should stay out of politics or because they're scared that if they agreed to hear the case, there'd be a Nobel Peace Prize-nominated Black Lives Matter mob outside their house threatening their kids. It doesn't matter what reason you apply to that. It's that if you're arguing about judges, you're already... If you're obsessing on judges, you're already playing defense. And we have to get back to actually... You know, right now... Lots of people, right now, we're in the next few years, we're going to see this immense automation that I think is going to put tons and tons of people out of work. People are going to be leading pointless lives. They're not going to be leading lives of worth and dignity where they leave the house every morning to go off and work and support their families. So the question is, do they become like the leisured Antifa types you see rampaging through the street for months on end in Portland, just eternal sophomores for whom requirements like, taking out the garbage and painting your spare bedroom never actually come into play? Are they going to be sitting there, in other words, with all this time to fester and obsessed on equity? Or are they going to be demanding parties that have policies that will restore the possibility of leading lives of basic human dignity to them? That's the great imponderable. You know, Kevin makes a very interesting point here, because I remember saying, I think it was 8 years ago, when Romney didn't expect to lose. Mitt was actually surprised. I talked to him by phone a couple of weeks after the election. He said he was like stunned. He had no idea he was going to lose. He thought this is how out of it these guys are. He thought he had it in the bag. And I remember saying I think I wrote a column about it, that if we had compulsory voting in the United States, like they do in Australia, you know how that would go. You know how that would go. Now, I'm not in favour of compulsory voting. They have it in Australia, and it has certain consequences, some of which are good and some of which are bad. But I'm not getting into an argument here about the merits of compulsory voting, which I think is philosophically problematic in many ways. But if you had it, do you really think the Republicans would win? You know, when you abandon all the other outposts of society, you just got to get back in there. Just got to get back in there. We're serializing 1984 at the moment. 1984 is worth 1,000 political tracts in its cultural power. So you can't have this, you know, for a start, you can't have a small ball, shrunken Republican Party going back to, you know, tax cuts, because there's nothing romantic about it. Who needs a tax cut? Look at those guys. If you're like in the seventh year of some worthless bachelor's degree at an American university, your adulthood is so deferred, you don't even comprehend what a tax cut is. You're not in that game. It's got nothing to do with your life. And so we got to get back in those games. George Schmidt writes, "Hi, Mark, I just signed in and saw the welcome to the new members. I'm the one in Font Hill, Ontario." You don't actually know that, George. We might have had a big surge of new members from Font Hill, Ontario. It might not just be you. You should sneak down to Tim Hortons and ensnare the other patrons in conversation. You might be the whole Tim Hortons. 87% of them might be members of the Mark Steyn Club. You don't know that. George says, "Great to be here on an island of sanity in a sea of chaos." Thank you, George. It's great to have you with us. Michael Cavino, thank you. And do ask a question next time, because we'd like to address whatever the burning issues are in my home province of Ontario. Michael Cavino writes, "Hi, Mark. You once noted that Biden's corn pop story was the greatest political story strategy in the history of American politics. Do you think Joe will ever invite corn pop to the White House for a photo op?" You know, Joe Biden's performance is very strange. If he hadn't been set up with the lowering expectations things, which we all did to him during the last year, you know, the sleepy Joe, wrong term for him, he's corrupt, he's sleazy Joe. And then the bits about him having dementia and all the rest of it. And on the first day, he was like signing all these executive orders. He basically dismantled the Trump presidency in 17 executive orders that he signed. And he seemed reasonably together and he got through the speech. And I thought, oh, this is nice, good for Joe. His dementia is all cleared up now. But it's getting so strange now, where he'll just, you know, he'll take a couple of questions at a press conference and then someone will ask him a question. And it's not particularly difficult. It's just like he hasn't been focused and he just walks off. He doesn't behave according to the norms of a functioning person in that position. And in his mind, the corn pop thing is where when he's talking about being the pool guard, the swimming pool guard all those years ago, and he's talking about how the children liked the way his leg hairs stood on end when he'd sit them on his knee. And he's talking about taking the rusting bicycle chain to corn pop. And calling him Esther Williams because he wore a bathing hat. That's Joe Biden. And the question is, when he's rhapsodized, when his eyes are shut and he's in his basement, presumably the basement at the White House now, and he's dreaming of corn pop, he's dreaming of Esther Williams in Dangerous When Wet or Million Dollar Mermaid, and he's thinking about how the children used to like it when his leg hair stood on end when they sat on his knee. The question is, how much of that seeps out into the wider world And people just suddenly realise they're living under Governor Le Petitmaine, or whatever he was called, in Blazing Saddles, because that's basically who he is right now. Now, I'll take one more. Let's see what we got. Have we got anything? Maybe I'm trying to see, find something that isn't on. Let's have a... Sharon says, Mark, could you comment on the murderous inclination of the left as evidenced by the sudden flip-flop by Facebook on HCQ for treating COVID-19, waiting for flip-flops on the other drugs that non-leftist physicians created protocols for? Isn't this proof that they absolutely wanted people to die in order to sink Trump? I'm so upset by this, mostly because I know nobody will pay any price for the avoidable deaths or murders, really. Yeah, I think that's true. That I think, for example, the delaying the vaccine, the announcement of the vaccine, real people died because of that. Real people died by the policies adopted by certain governors, but they felt that in the scheme of things, that those deaths would be hung around Trump's neck. And I think it's worth bearing this in mind. I think about this occasionally. Not just with respect to myself, but to certain friends and more prominent people in public life, that I actually think the left is okay with death in a political for the political cause. And that's certainly true now. All the evidence, whether you're talking about the teenage suicides, the people in the old folks' home, basically, the left is okay with death. It doesn't mean they necessarily want to take the machete to you and decapitate you themselves. Not yet. Not like the jihadist guys. But death that serves their political interests, they're cool with, and they like a lot of death. Let me see. We've got some questions in 1984. I'll hold off on those for a bit because we'll be having our thing coming up. There was one question. Let me see if I can find this. There was one question I wanted to get. Oh yeah, it's I'll have a practical question. Paul Nachman says, you've talked about the superiority of simple paper ballots hand-counted where they're cast. Nolo contendere. But even though you've lived in New Hampshire for decades, I wonder if you're carrying over too much from your Canadian experience, wherein an election consists of a single race, the choice of the Member of Parliament for a provincial or federal riding. To clarify for non-Canadians, that's one or the other, not both. Paul says he checked with James Fulford, who lives in Toronto. But in US elections, there can easily be a dozen candidates on the ballot, as well as ballot questions. E.g., in Montana, besides the presidential US senator and congressional representative races, we just elected governor, attorney general, secretary of state, superintendent of public instruction, regional member of the public service commission, state legislators, some local officials, plus we voted on several ballot questions. In principle, you could go to a separate piece of paper for each contest, but I think the resulting blizzard of paper would likely yield chaos that might well be as fraught as what we're stuck with now. So regarding your recommended elections regime, am I missing something obvious? Yeah, I think I've clarified this, that I am in favour of separating federal office and state elections. So if you're electing the president or you're electing a United States senator or a US representative, this should be done to a single uniform federal standard. And if necessary, that should mean you can have a separate ballot. You just need two. You could have a separate piece of paper for the federal offices and then another ballot for the state ones, or, which is the one I prefer, do as they do in Canada and other parts of the Commonwealth, and have the federal and provincial elections on different days. So in New Hampshire, for example, you could have the state elections on town meeting day, for example. And then it's for each state to determine how those elections are run. New Hampshire has offices for everything. Offices for everything, overseer of the poor, sexton, all these offices. And yet we use paper ballots. We're not a machine state. I don't mind if corrupt, sleazy Democrat precincts want to run their elections in the way they do. But I think what's essential at the moment is that for the only two federal offices that every American vote for, which is the president and the vice president, that there should be a uniform national standard. We've overrun. Thank you for that question, Paul, but that's my position. I'm in favor of separate. I don't see why everything has to be done on Tuesday in November, and I'd be in favor of separating U.S. and state elections. Look, we need something new. New. Otherwise, it's over. It's over. Unless this is reversed, it's over. I thought that was pathetic. The Sunday before the election, just waving the pocket constitution around as if it's a talisman. It's not. It's the basic law of a nation. And if it's interpreted by judges who are appointed by Democrats, then you wind up in the world we're living in now, where the plain meaning of those words is tortured to mean something entirely different. Edward Braun, I will have one more closing question. Edward Braun says, concerning third party, Nigel Farage formed a party in a matter of weeks and look at his success. That's true. In the European elections, he formed it 5 weeks beforehand and he drove the Tories to their worst result in centuries. President Trump has a loyal base. My wife and I are examples, and we would be joined by the other millions of his followers. I said 4 years ago, the Democrats have a base. Trump has a base. It's not clear to me that the McConnell-Ryan Republican establishment has a base. We'll see where we are on that. We've overrun badly. I do apologize to all of you. We'll have our latest episode of 1984 and our first Sunday edition of the 100 Years Ago show, all movies and music and a lot of other stuff all over the weekend. Have a fabulous weekend. And if you're in Australia or the Chatham Islands or wherever, and it's almost over, I hope it was a good one for you. We will see you next time.